righty, now let's see if we can get through this, Deitch, without somebody doing something stupid and completely screwing stuff up. I'm not talking about you or me or Derek or Mark or anybody. I'm talking about what happened yesterday in the last hour of our show, and just briefly to update people. We were on the air when Major League Soccer announced that Toronto FC had been given permission to play a couple of home games, and that the Montreal Impact had been given permission to play a home game by the federal government, that border restrictions were being... Well, basically MLS, the Major League Soccer Players Association, and its head office got together, and everybody worked for the benefit of everybody else and decided the easiest thing to do is just go along with whatever the Canadian government wants. Let's make this as smooth as possible. So the decision was reached that non-vaccinated players and officials wouldn't be allowed to come over the border, let alone play. Boom. I thought there was some kind of green shoots there for a minute. So we talked about it. We had Bill Manning, the Toronto FC president, on with us. And ended the show, got in the car, and then I'm hearing that the feds are saying, actually, no, wait a minute. Nothing has been made official yet. What seems to have happened here is one minister's office reached agreement with Major League Soccer, and Major League Soccer may have jumped the gun in this in some fashion. Anyhow, bottom line, Richard, is the games, after all this got settled, those games are going ahead. There will be fans in the stands. In Toronto, it'll be 7,000 for Saturday's game. And that will include a select group of season's ticket holders and frontline healthcare workers, doctors, et cetera, et cetera. And the other bottom line is the Toronto Blue Jays, the other team that's awaiting indication from the federal government about a possible return, they're still waiting. And as we said yesterday, the two... Toronto FC and the Blue Jays, these are two different situations. We're talking about more players with the Blue Jays coming across the border with major league teams. We're talking about a greater length of time. And we're also talking about players coming not from their home cities necessarily to Toronto, but from other markets. And clearly, if you've been paying attention to the news out of the U.S. today, there are some markets where the variants are running, I wouldn't say running wild, but certainly on the uptick to the point that now we're sort of seeing the U.S. try to restart its stalled vaccination program. So all this aside, Richard, Shai Davidi doing an excellent reporting job this afternoon, talking to Dr. Howard New, Canada's Deputy Chief Public Health Officer, who said that the Blue Jays application to host games at Rogers Centre is, quote, trending in a very good direction and doesn't include any, quote, showstoppers. Now, I didn't know if he was talking about the Blue Jays bullpen or the application, but anyhow, it doesn't include any showstoppers, although he couldn't give a timeline for a decision. The Jays have said they need to know by tomorrow so that they can begin plans to play in Toronto on July 30th. That would appear to be, well, let's just not say anything because who the hell knows what's going to happen between now and 5. But that brings you up to date to where we are, Richard. And I will say this about the Blue Jays. They have done a remarkable job of adhering to a message and not screwing this up.
Yeah, well, there's a good recap there. There's a lot to chew on this. First off, once again, I cannot continue to laugh at those people, a smaller segment that it is every day, who continue to want to believe that sports and politics don't intersect. They literally intersect every single day in your life, including this, because it's not only health considerations here, but political considerations. Absolutely. So let's take the Blue Jays, Jeff, because this is obviously, no offense to Toronto FC, this is the bigger one. In reading Shai's reporting, and you're right, he's done a great job on a topic he probably never expected to cover. It's leaning towards the Blue Jays are coming back. Like, I'm now convinced this is going to happen. The only question I think, Jeff, that remains is whether the decision-making process happens fast enough where they can get here July 30th, or the decision-making process happens where whatever the next date would be. I think it's been thrown around like August 20th or something like that is the date. But I don't think I don't think Howard New, Dr. New, is coming out with that statement without really knowing that, like, they're pretty close to a decision. I don't think you're putting that into the ether, because that once you put that out there, like, you can't really sort of turn around from it. So I think it's going to happen. And now, to me, it's really just a question of, and I wish I knew sort of the government procedures more, just how quickly, like, a decision like that is made. Who are the decision makers that have to make it? What's the processes for the decision to happen? And, like, can that happen in whatever the time frame is to get to July 30th? I think I told you this yesterday. Again, just a total guess on my part, but I always thought that we were talking August or September for the Blue Jays, and I'll stick with that just because I think it seems to me, if I'm reading the tea leaves, that the decision isn't going to come quick enough for this first date. But I, at this point now, would honestly be stunned if the Blue Jays are not playing baseball at the Rogers Center in late August or September.
Yeah, I think back about a month ago that somebody with the team, not admittedly a decision maker, a baseball ops person, told me that just their read of the situation was August 20th. Just based on kind of what
I think that makes sense.
Done and all this stuff. And it was just in a discussion. And the person said, August 20th probably seems more realistic to me. And that's always kind of stuck in the back of my mind. The interesting thing will be how non-vaccinated players are handled.
Well, if they go by the letter of the law, I mean, they can't let him in, right? I mean, unless I'm misreading government is approaching this, I don't think they can get an exemption to go into the country, right?
I don't think they can get it right now. This is what I found interesting about the fact that if you read the announcement, Toronto FC is really only guaranteed the next two games at home. I don't know if you could get it right now, but two things that I found really sort of interesting about this, and we'll be joined by Josh Klokey of the Athletic to talk about this in a few minutes. Bill Manning made very clear to us that essentially the Major League Soccer Players Association was very much involved in this. Like, think about it. The Major League Soccer players, the teams coming into Toronto, have basically agreed to not take their vaccinated players with them. Now, I don't know the individual. It could very well be that the individual team circumstances, the non-vax players aren't starters anyhow, or not important players anyhow. But the fact that you got that agreement from the Players Association, I don't know what the dispensation would be like for baseball, because as we said, we're talking more players, we're talking a longer period of time, and we are talking players who could be in the middle of a road trip. So they're not they're not coming from their originating city. And I guess you could have tests and all this stuff to figure out a way around this. But yeah, again, baseball players have had access to vaccines now since February, I think. And there are people out there. First of all, I understand there are people out there who still have a hard time believing that professional athletes, that there are a percentage of professional athletes who wouldn't get vaccinated. But, I mean, there are. There's just as there's a percentage of people in society that aren't going to listen to the science. And we can have a debate about individual rights, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. Bottom line is you were never, ever going to have every player in baseball vaccinated. Bottom line is I honestly don't know if every NHL player that's come into this country has been vaccinated. We've never really received an answer about that. But my worry is this, Richard, if you are a player who has not been vaccinated by now, when you've had, in the case of the Chicago Cubs, your general manager come out and say, guys, this is a competitive balance argument for us. We get guys who are sick. It's gonna impact where we are in the standings. Same with the Philadelphia Phillies. Guys, if we have a COVID outbreak, we're screwed. That's lost postseason money. That's lost money in your pockets. If that pressure hasn't worked yet, I guarantee you that guys, go get vaccinated so we can go up to Toronto and give the Blue Jays a home field advantage. That's not going to work either. So the bottom line is going to be, how do we account for those players who aren't vaccinated? And I'm going to say this because I don't know. It's also entirely possible that there are Blue Jays players who aren't vaccinated. And if that's the case, you're basically telling someone you're going to be in a bubble for 6 weeks. Because once you go out of Canada with the Blue Jays, once you travel back into the U.S., at some point you're probably going to be coming back into Canada. So there's a lot of considerations here. And the fact that Shai had a conversation with Tony Clark, and the one thing I hang on here is that Shai came away, and Tony, when it comes to really, really, really important stuff, Tony is pretty transparent. Shai came away very much with the idea that Tony Clark understood the nuances of the Canadian thing and that he didn't think it would necessarily be that big an issue. So that's another positive.
Yeah, so this, I mean, just this is just my opinion, and I imagine certainly be a ton of people disagreeing with me. I would keep a hard line, Jeff, on athletes who are not vaccinated coming into the country. I would not allow them in. To me, that's the line that I don't think you could bypass because
but
you have
don't
asked.
Don't know if you've already allowed on. I agree.
Jeff, I get it.
But are we certain they haven't?
I understand that. All I'm saying is that the country has been very clear about who can come in and who cannot, and you have not been able to enter this country as a non-resident, permanent resident, or non-citizen if you are not vaccinated. And I would not change – I would not give professional athletics an exemption on that. To me, that is on the organization. That – If the Rays are coming into Toronto and they only have 86% of their players vaxxed, well, then only 86% of their players are crossing my border. I would not change that, but I realize that – I shouldn't say I realize. My guess is that I do think they will get an exception. My guess is the Canadian government will provide some kind of exception for teams to come in. But if I were in charge, that's the line I would not cross, because I think then you are giving these leagues an exemption that far outweighs something that you have asked of the general citizenry, and I would not go there. That's just me.
Yeah, there are travelers, people who are not fully vaccinated have been allowed to come into the country.
But tell me if I'm right or wrong. Are they not Canadian citizens or permanent residents, which to me makes a difference?
My reading is you can do it, but then you have to go through the whole.
You got to come into the country and quarantine for 14 days. Yeah. But these athletes are not going to do that. They'll be out of here in three, right?
Correct.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, again, there's a lot of things that these officials have to deal with. I don't like that precedent personally. But again, it may not matter. In honestly a month or a month and a half, if the Canadian government basically changes its restrictions anyway and says, okay, people can now come into the country if whatever, if vaxxed once or if this or if that. So these are all going to change anyway based on, the state of vaccinations and the state of case counts in the country.
Yeah, you are right. I think...
I just want to say quickly, I did hear Barker, and I'm totally with him on this. If they can somehow get back home, Jeff, in August or September, I think it's a major advantage. We're not talking about how big an advantage it could be.
Oh, well, no, I mean, we talked about it on Baseball Central because their players are unhappy.
You guys have done a great job. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was going to say real quick.
Yeah.
Your show's done a great job. I heard Barker talking about just even pitchers sort of having to deal with minor league mounds and change it. He's totally dead on. It's really interesting. We probably don't know how much these guys have had to change because they're not playing in a major league facility.
Right. And I think we'll have a better idea. There will be more reporters around the team. My understanding is there'll be more reporters around the team this weekend. But again, anecdotally, just from text exchanges with a couple of players and coaches and that, they'll tell you it's old. The whole, we're the happy wanderers. Yeah, that ain't the case anymore. And the move to Buffalo and the series against the Yankees, where the percentage of fans was about 90% Yankees fans to Blue Jays fans, although totally expected because it's Buffalo. But that, I can tell you, there was a lot of talking in the players at that point that, okay, we've kind of, this the romance has gone out of this. It's time to get back to the big league ballpark. And Barker's right. It's a different environment. The mounds are different. The fields are different. The wind in Dunedin. All that stuff. And I know people are rolling their eyes, but you got to remember, a lot of these guys had a choice, right? Like, I guarantee you that when Hyunjin Ryu signed his big contract, at no point did he think he was going to be pitching in a minor league park. And that's kind of where we are with this. But certainly, you're right. Everything Dr. Howard New said today leads me to believe that the ducks are lined up, and there may be some last minute negotiating or something that needs to be done yet. But I don't know, maybe it's simply a matter of getting a clear read on who exactly is and isn't vaccinated on the teams that may be coming into Canada. I mean, who knows? But I do take solace from the fact that the head of the Players Association seems to understand all this. But it's always we've talked about this, Richard, and I know you share my opinion. The Jays were always going to be the hardest nut to crack here. They were, just for a variety of reasons. Of all the teams coming back in here, this was going to be the hardest nut to crack. And I guess the fact that there's a hotel attached to the Rogers Centre, maybe
helps,
visiting,
right? Should help.
Maybe visiting players, quote unquote, quarantine in that hotel. But anyhow, hopefully.
Yeah, Jeff, let me just sort of state, like, clearly, like, I know you said this too. I'm with you on this. I don't think, like, the danger to the public is the issue. In fact, quite frankly, I think the danger to the public is almost nil with these players coming in.
Absolutely.
Given all the logistics. I do think, though, that there is, in theory, danger to the opposing team, in this case, the Blue Jays. Like, you know, that's a real thing if you're bringing people in who are not vaccinated and players interact with personnel around the ballpark. So it's less of a public health issue to me in some ways than it is a potential issue or liability to the Blue Jays. But if it does happen, and this is one thing I'm very convinced that the Blue Jays will take care of, as well as the opposing teams, they will essentially hermetically seal these other teams off so that, you know, between flying into Toronto, getting to the hotel, getting into the ballpark, the amount of interaction these guys will have with the general public will be very, very low.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, and but I also think we'd also both be on the same page here that there, and you were right about this. There's an element of optics here. There really is, and I understand there are a lot of people out there who just want everything back to normal and want the players back and all that stuff. And hey, I would love everything to come back to normal too. But again, I'm willing to let public health and science lead the way here. And you know, maybe I'm guilty of reading too much into the variants and all that, but the numbers around the world are not encouraging when it comes to variants.
Yeah. And don't let cable news hosts lead the conversation. Let public health.
Yeah. Exactly. And if public health people have some concern about this, you know, I'm willing to go along.
I hope, though,
I want the messaging to be like yesterday. Yesterday was not a good look.
No.
Yesterday was not a good look.
Respect to TFC, but it feels like they jumped a little early here. Not to play conspiracy theorist, but I now sort of feel why Bill Manning wouldn't answer our multiple questions about who he talked to in the government. I mean, it sort of does play out a little because maybe they jumped. But, that's ultimately going to work out. And I will say this, and I say this as an American, I appreciate that the Canadian government has been pretty conservative when it comes to certain things, in particular like athletics in this country. And I think long term that will prove to be the correct decision. Even as a sports fan, like, I want these guys back. Like, obviously, I wish the Leafs had a crowd at home and maybe it changed that series. But I think they have been smarter here in terms of being very diligent before they open it up. But I do think, Jeff, we're on the cusp of this. And if this decision doesn't happen by July 30th, like you said, I'm convinced it happens by August 20th.
Yeah, I think we're both on the same page here. Joshua Cloak covers Toronto FC for The Athletic. He's also author of Come On You Reds, the story of Toronto FC. This much we know, Toronto FC will be playing on Saturday. And apparently Jozy Altidore is back in the fold. So all is right in the world of the Reds, right? Well, Josh will join us to tell us. This is Writer's Block. I admit I was a little confused about this. As of last week, fully vaccinated travelers who were eligible to come into Canada, and that included foreign pro athletes with valid work permits, were not required to adhere to a 14-day quarantine as long as they complied with things like pre- and post-arrival testing and all that. The 14-day quarantine continues to apply if you aren't vaccinated. So there is no...
There's no wiggle room.
Well, you can come into the country as a non-vaccinated
athlete, but you got to quarantine. You're supposed to right.
So in theory, there's no reason. Like if you're Orlando City, there's no reason to bring. What are you going to bring somebody in who isn't vaccinated for? Just so they can stay in their. That's a point of clarity there.
Yeah, I just want to say, Jeff, I mean, maybe we'll get to the end of the show, but like it does really bring up an interesting discussion on competitiveness in terms of. Like, let's say MLB goes forward. Like, would you bring 21 of 24 players? Like, you know what I mean? It's interesting.
Yeah, my understanding is that there are. I hope I get this right. My understanding was that every organization has ensured that a number of AAA players are vaccinated. So that the, for example,
so you have like
if
a taxi squad,
right? For example, if a AAA player gets called up from another team, that's my understanding, anyhow. So we do know, we don't know that, but we do know that Toronto FC will be playing Saturday against Orlando City SC, and then New York Red Bulls on Wednesday. We also know that CF Montreal, getting a hard time calling them CF Montreal, is going to play on Saturday. Against Cincinnati. Joshua Cloak of The Athletic covers the Reds and Major League Soccer, soccer in general. He's also author of Come On, You Reds, the story of Toronto FC, and he joins us on Writer's Block. Joshua, thank you very much for doing this. Congratulations on actually being able to cover a team in Toronto with people in the stands. Well done. You're our grand prize winner. You're our grand prize winner for getting that. What happened yesterday to this thing? What's your reading on how the word got out, how it was handled? Because there was, I think, for about less than an hour, it was kind of a, well, we kind of said yes, but we haven't said yes approach to this whole thing. What's your reading how this happened?
Well, I think there was just a lot of confusion, and a lot of that confusion was certainly exasperated by the fact, or embellished, I guess, by the fact that, you know, this also raises questions about what's going to happen with the Blue Jays, right? Are the Blue Jays going to be able to come back? And, you know, that's obviously there's plenty of questions to ask about that. But I think what happened here, if you read MLS's statement, you know, that was released where they said Toronto FC and Club de Foot Montreal, that's what I prefer to call them. It's kind of a catchier way than CF Montreal. It sort of sounds like MLS just kind of forced, you know, everyone's hand and said, we're kind of tired of waiting here. We know that if, like you said, if players are double vaccinated, they don't have to be subject to that 14-day quarantine. So they're kind of coming back. So it definitely read as if MLS just said, look, these are two teams that have been out of market for far too long. It's having a real negative impact on players, on coaches, on management, on families. So this is just the right thing to do, you know, and then there was some confusion from the federal government about whether or not this had actually been approved. We learned later that it had been approved, but the games afterwards are still kind of subject to change. Bill Manning told me that, you know, they had an NIE, a national interest exemption application filed for those games afterwards, and they're just kind of waiting on approval for that exemption, but made no mention of the first two games. So, you know, as it turns out, those first two games, Saturday and Wednesday, have been approved and they're going forward, but that kind of clarity wasn't introduced, I guess, in the original statement right away. And it's difficult because, you know, we're all kind of flying by the seat of our pants this season, right? Things are changing day to day, and it's been very difficult to get a read on what's happening with TFC, given that they're, you know, training and playing in another country. We get to talk to them and management and coaches, you know, maybe once a week. So it's difficult to kind of get a read on things. So this all kind of came together very quickly, and that's why I think there were a lot of questions yesterday.
Josh, we didn't really get a chance to talk to Bill Manning about this, but we will with you. I mean, just very simply, like, this team has been very easy to score on, and they clearly are not having the year they expected. Managerial decision turned out to be a disaster. Why, in your opinion, and maybe it's multiple reasons, but why has this team failed in every way, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think disaster is the right word here. I think there's just everything that could have gone wrong this season for Toronto FC has gone wrong. I mean, you can go back to when Greg Vanney decides he's not going to come back to Toronto, and, you know, he says he kind of wants to go elsewhere and build, you know, somewhere else. Greg Vanney had spent years and years doing a really good job building a team to play to a very specific style. And he relied a lot on veteran players, players with a lot of, you know, MLS experience who were comfortable holding onto the ball, playing a very slow, methodical, possession-based style of play. When he leaves, he kind of takes his support staff, including the sports science people, with him. So for a long time in the offseason, a lot of players didn't have very clear offseason training kind of guidance. So that kind of ups the possibility of early injuries, right? And we saw a number of players getting injured early in the season. So there's that. You're also asking a team now, when they bring on Chris Armas, who is asking the team to play a much more intense style of play, a lot more running, a lot more pressing. You're asking a team to do that has been used to playing a completely different style of play. And I don't think General Manager Ali Curtis, did a good enough job to bring in the necessary pieces to kind of support Chris in this newfound style of play. And you know, you're asking players to do more running, do more intense pressing when they're living and training in some pretty, I think we can call it oppressive Florida heat, right? So again, the likelihood of injuries is only going to compound there. And in terms of them getting scored against, yeah, again, they were just early in the season while they're learning this new style of play and they're focusing on getting the X's and O's right. They were just so volatile in the back and they were just so susceptible to counterattacks. That's really what it was. And, you know, they just didn't have the legs to play this style. So when teams figured out that they could hit TFC on the counter, they could literally run them into the ground. And it's just things just kept getting worse game after game. So a really, really disappointing start. And I guess the question now is the hole that they've kind of dug too big to climb out of in terms of the playoffs. They're going to need to go on a real, real serious run right now. And now you've lost a number of key pieces to the Gold Cup. So the deck is certainly stacked against TFC right now.
Josh, was the issue with Josie Altidore a Josie Chris Armas thing, or was it wider than that?
Yeah, my read and my understanding in talking to people in and around the club is that it definitely was wider than that. I mean, it's no secret that you know, Ali Curtis has been interested in kind of shopping Josie and seeing if there's a taker for Josie, you know, for the last little bit. Josie has struggled with injuries over the last few seasons. When he's on his game and fit, you know, he's probably about as lethal a striker or among, you know, some of the better strikers in MLS right now. But him being completely fit, it has become a bit of a rarity, right? And, you know, Josie Altidore is a club legend, you know, and he's rightly viewed as such. But he's also a player that was very much brought back, you know, kind of at the behest of Bill Manning. You know, you have to go back to the point when Josie Altidore was re-signed. They just lost Sebastian Giovinco, you know, the best player in club history. And I don't think the club at that point really wanted to lose another player. Jose had just 1 year left on his deal. So you bring him back and, you know, you make him a key piece of this team. But in doing so, you're kind of overlooking some of the serious injuries that he's had. So there was some interest from teams abroad, but you know, Jose has a pretty hefty salary and there weren't as many teams that were willing to match that salary as maybe TFC would have hoped. So, you know, Josie's kind of confrontation with Chris Armas, I think, was part of it, but it was also maybe an opportunity to really, you know, look throughout the market and see if there was a taker for Josie. But, you know, when Chris is fired, you know, a move that I think we can all agree was just probably had to be done given the way they played in their last game under him. It just provided the perfect opportunity with the team coming back to just say, look, you know, we want you part of this team. As much as we're having trouble, you know, allowing goals, they're also having trouble scoring goals. And I don't know if it's the most prudent move to allow, you know, your designated player who's eating up a big portion of your salary to just sit on the bench. So I think bringing him back, you know, does make a lot of sense if you're Bill Manning and you want to kind of put your best foot forward for a club that, you know, has probably lost a bit of touch with their fan base. So I do think it was deeper than just Chris and Josie. But I still don't know, and I don't think a lot of people know, you know, what the future holds for him. It looks good right now, but if they do get a real good offer for Josie, and it's somewhere Josie wants to go, I don't know how you don't consider it, right?
Josh, one last quick one.
I'm with you completely.
Yeah, one last quick one for me, Josh, and that is, as you look at the roster, seems clear to me, and you just obviously hit on Altidore, but like these guys have to really, don't these guys have to bring in a significant designated player for next year?
No, I think so. I think this club is long overdue for a serious retooling, and I guess you could even say rebuild of the roster. You just look at some of the pieces on the roster. I just think they're holding on to 2017, which, you know, it needs to be said, probably the greatest team in MLS history, just an incredible run, you know, to the final in Mexico. It was an incredible team to kind of follow. But I just think there are too many pieces from that 2017 still with the club. And I think this is a team that needs to, I would say desperately needs to get younger, needs to get faster, needs to kind of be more in tune with just that quicker style of play that I think a lot of coaches want to play, but we don't know who their long-term coach is going to be. And my hope, I guess, and I think the hope of a lot of TFC fans, at least the fans that I talk to, is that when this new coach comes in, be it at the end of the season, be it, you know, next season, he has more of a say in terms of roster construction. He can find the players that he wants and he needs to play his style of play, because I don't think that was the case with Chris Armas. And again, I think that's a big reason why, you know, TFC are so far at the bottom of the standings right now.
Josh, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys.
Take care. That's Josh Cloak. He covers Toronto FC for The Athletic, MLS soccer. He covers a bunch of stuff for The Athletic. But we appreciate him joining us. And yeah, it's... I cannot imagine, you know, we've talked about all the Toronto teams being away from home and everything like that. And you know, I think the Raptors are the team that we, you know, we focus on as really having had a tough go. But my God, Richard, it had to be horrible. It had to be horrible to be in Toronto, on Toronto FC last year. I mean, they were practicing they're practicing on a baseball diamond at one point last year when they were in Hartford.
Hartford.
And look, and I understand. Yeah, exactly. My thought exactly. It's not, and I always have to throw this caveat in, right? These guys get paid pretty well, et cetera, et cetera, all of that stuff. But again, nobody signed up for it. And yeah, you got to deal with it. But
and that's a sport where emotion and the crowd, Jeff, has real meaning. Like Atlanta United, those Pacific Northwest teams in MLS, Toronto's fan base, they have big advantages because of how loud and boisterous, you know, those fan bases make it very hard to play for road opponents. And to not even be able to play, even if you don't have a crowd, not even be able to play in your home facility. I mean, I still think the Raptors had it hardest just given the amount of games and and what they've had to go through, particularly the bubble, was really mentally draining, particularly what was going on with George Floyd in the U.S. But, man, Toronto FC, the Blue Jays, the Raptors, they've all had to deal with stuff that no other organizations had to deal with in sports.
Well, we know that Bradley Beal will not be going to the Tokyo Olympics as a member of Team USA. He is in health and safety protocols, COVID-19 health and safety protocols. We also know that Jeremy Grant, Team USA, has entered health and safety protocols, although that appears to be, quote, out of an abundance of caution. There is still hope that he could clear the protocols in time to travel with Team USA next week. But Richard, Team USA, the men's basketball team, is kind of a mess right now, and this certainly won't help it. So Bradley Beal isn't going to the Olympics, but you know who is? Dan Wojcicki of the LA Times, and he'll join us next. This is Writer's Block. I'm going to credit my co-host, Richard Deitch, with an analysis of the NBA Finals. We were talking about, we were trying to figure out what people's interest level would be in these finals, beyond sort of hardcore, beyond the hardcore basketball fans. And Deitch made an interesting point about how he thinks this final will really resonate with people if it goes to seven games. And a lot of people are saying, well, yeah, obviously a seven-game final is going to attract more people. But, Richard, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're saying, if we have seven games here, that probably means Giannis and Chris Paul. That means all the stars of this series have played pretty well, or at least have had their moments. And I'm giving you credit for that because Giannis Antetokounmpo last night had one of those moments. All seen LeBron James is a great player, but I've always told people the LeBron James moment I remember is that block. Last night, Giannis gave us his LeBron moment.
My analysis on this was that the series needed length because, Jeff, these were two teams that are not polarizing. Generally speaking, they're generally likable, so they're sort of both baby-faced teams, and mm-hmm. you needed, I thought, the series to go long for it to have either some great moments or get a little bit edgy. And last night was far and away, Jeff, the best game of the series, and I thought one of the best games in recent years for an NBA Finals. I watched that whole game. I mean, that was honestly thrilling stuff. And, like, you didn't have to have any fandom of the Bucks or the Suns to really be into that game. And so I thought that was a great night for the NBA. That was really exciting to watch.
Yeah, and the other thing we're seeing, too, as well, is we're starting to see some other storylines develop, and that plays into this. Once you kind of see players, if you're a neutral, if you can have players you could cheer for, or players you dislike, or players that are impressing you.
Devin Booker and Giannis have, I think, stepped up.
Yep.
In terms of just recognizability and stardom. And I'm not to say they weren't stars before, but, like, last night, like, was unbelievable theater. And you also got a non-six foul call, which could have been one of the worst non-calls in the history of the finals. I mean, last night was a really good night for the NBA because a lot of stuff happened.
Dan Wojcicki is the NBA reporter with the LA Times, and we want to talk to Dan about not just about the NBA Finals, but also the Tokyo Olympics as well. Dan, thanks so much for joining us. Look, it's safe to say that the momentum in these NBA Finals has shifted. I'm going to ask you, did you see this coming after seeing Phoenix play the way they played those first couple of games?
Am I going to sound like a liar if I say yes? I might sound like a liar. I guess is sort of where I'm at. And that's sort of, I think, and Richard kind of touched on this a little bit too. It's sort of the beauty of this series because, these teams are imperfect teams. You know, I think injuries and circumstance has sort of, contributed to their place in the finals, and that's fine. I'm not saying that as a slight in any stretch. But because of those imperfections, like, I never felt like this was going to be a four or five game series. Like, quite frankly, I didn't think either team was good enough, you know? And so I think some of their flaws and their mistakes have opened the doors for great drama. I covered Chris Paul for 7 years, when he was with the Clippers, you know, there day in, day out. If I had a dollar for every time I heard Chris Paul say a series doesn't start till the home team loses, I would not be having this conversation right now, guys. I'd be on a beach somewhere, you know? And so, like, this, I think, is like, you know, we'll see who can pull this off. And the fun part is that, like, I don't think either of these teams, like I said, are good enough to guarantee that the other team can't do it, you know? That's what's sort of fun about this series. And one of the things that I was most excited about, I was in Phoenix for the first two games, and then kind of tapped out to get ready for Tokyo. But those first two games, like, even though Phoenix played terrific and the Bucks kind of stunk, like, those games weren't blowouts. They were sort of within reach, and it's kind of like two boxers who don't have great defense who are just throwing haymakers, and, you know, it makes for good action. And I think we've seen, like, a lot of really kind of fun moments in the series so far already.
Dan, whenever we have a Los Angeles-based NBA writer, I was worth pointing out, no yes. titles for Kawhi Leonard since he left Toronto, so that's part
that's
one.
Correct.
That's right. Secondly, you know, Giannis is a star, unquestionably so, a yep. unicorn, one of the great players in the league. What I want to ask you, though, as a national guy who, you know, talks to these guys and sort of takes the temperature of the league, if he wins this series, especially given some of the games that we've seen from him, Do you think, like, the NBA public thinks of him differently? Does he, like, go from – I don't want to compare him to all-time, but you know what I'm saying? Like, does he go
yeah,
from
yeah.
however you sort of think of a star, like an all-NBA type of current player,
yeah,
to
I mean, like,
something more?
I think so. And part of this, I think, kind of goes to the way that – it's hard for me to kind of say – speak to, you know, how the public's going to react on this type of stuff because – the public has been doing all sorts of crazy stuff for the last few years, and it's hard to keep up with. But, you know, people, like, this is a two-time MVP of this, and people do not talk about Giannis like he is a two-time MVP. You know, and that's because of the playoff stumbles, I think, is a huge part of that. And when you hear, and sort of also, I think, the combination of, like, just, like, his raw, like, sort of athleticism and how unorthodox he is as a player and you know, a perceived lack of skill from some of his peers, you know, it's not – guys don't speak that highly of him, you know, in the same way that you would talk about a LeBron James or the same way that you would talk about a Luka Doncic or, you know, Kawhi Leonard. You know, some of these guys that match, like, supreme athleticism and physical gifts with, you know, tremendous skill. I do think Giannis is turning some of that opinion. Like, some people will always look at him and be like, this dude is a 6'11", like, you know, chiseled out of granite, you know, touched by the gods athlete. And he's worked within his agility to do this stuff, but, like, you know, he can't make a three-pointer, starts from the free throw line, blah, 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 right? And they'll concentrate on what he isn't. I think a title, what it does is it reshifts the focus and makes people concentrate on what you are. And some of those, I think, criticisms fade because it doesn't matter what he isn't. You know, when you win, if your jumper's broke, like, who cares? You won. And I think that'll be – I would kind of expect that to be the narrative around him, and how that would shift is that you would talk about him as a great MVP, as a player worthy of being in sort of that best-in-the-world consideration, which he kind of faded from after the last two postseasons.
Now, Dan, I want to talk a little bit about Tokyo. The game's coming up. We know
okay.
Brad.
I'm going to get into the fetal position. I'm getting ready for this, right?
I saw my first report from Tokyo, and having covered some Olympics, it was a very forlorn reporter wearing a mask outside the media center, and I was thinking, you know, there's going to be no 5 a.m. drinks on the patio at this one. I don't think like there normally is. It looked really joyless. I mean, I don't want to you know.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
You know what I'm saying, yeah. God, I thought you'd have enough seniority to avoid this.
The sound you're hearing is my enthusiasm balloon. Slowly popping. Yeah.
Is the U.S. basketball team going to give you enthusiasm at least?
It'll be fun. I think as someone who is pro-chaos, I think it'll be incredibly fun. You know, between – it's one of those things, like, you watch these games, and I keep having this thought that it's like, let's not overreact. A quarter of their team isn't there. They're still playing in the NBA Finals. And then, like, you take a step back and you're like, oh, my God, a quarter of their team is still playing in the NBA Finals. You know, like, I'm leaving on Monday. Like, these are going to get starting soon. Like, how are they going to get these guys? And I think,
it's a perfect storm between, you know, you had the fallout from sort of the NBA's bubble season and pandemic season kind of combined, which is someone who was in the bubble and covered it and then covered this year, following the Lakers around, not traveling, but like, you know, keep tabs on, like, it just felt like one big long season, guys. It truly did. You know, there really wasn't a break. And so I get kind of the lack of enthusiasm that some players had for going to Tokyo under, again, you know, pretty strict circumstances. Like you said, it's going to be purely based on competition. Like the pop and circumstance of the Olympics and all of that stuff is really gone. I don't know how you're going to recreate that with nobody in the building, except for people like me, who are just happy to be out of their hotel rooms. So I think that'll be chaotic. I think this potentially being Greg Popovich's last chance to win a championship of any kind is very interesting. And already seeing him get testy with reporters and stuff like that, I look forward to get into that mix. It'll be an interesting tournament. You know, I mean, I think the drama that doesn't exist, that used to, like, sort of, you'd go into these things and you'd be like, all right, the USA is going to win gold. You'd like, you put that down in pen, whatever. Like, that's sort of how I feel about the women's team now. And like, the men's team is like, they're in a fight, and you watch them and you see no Bradley Beal, who knows what's going to happen with Jeremy Grant. It's like, they had a hard time getting good players to commit the first time around. How are you going to get guys to commit on 6 days' notice? You know, are we pulling guys from the select team? You know, and it's not like that team was completely stacked. There's no Zion Williamson to call up, or something like that. So like, you're talking about guys like Keldon Johnson and Darius Garland. Like, that could be trouble. And that does make me excited. It'll be interesting to write about that for sure.
Dan, thanks so much for doing this, man. Listen, travel safely. Get out of the fetal position and enjoy yourself somehow. Take care.
Thanks, guys. Be good.
Thanks, Dan.
That's Dan Wojcicki of the LA Times.
Yeah. Jeff, by the way, just a quick prediction. I think the U.S. is going to lose. I can't tell you what round, but I don't think they're going to win the gold medal.
Okay. Can you imagine? I'm just thinking of this. Can you imagine if Trump was still in office and Greg Popovich was overseas with the U.S. team?
Ugh. I mean, if he's in office, just think of the sports-related Olympic tweets.
But you want to talk about chaos.
Oh, yeah. Well, Popovich has no problem going off on Trump. And so, yeah, let's not go down the road today, because, you know, today in the United States, some of the conversation was about potential coups of the country. So there you go.
Yes. Chris Johnson, NHL insider with Sportsnet, joins us. Jeff Passan, MLB insider with ESPN, will join us as well. Don't go anywhere. It's Writer's Block. A lot of active weather in the listening region today. There was an earlier tornado warning around Barrie, Ontario, and unconfirmed reports, it appears, of a tornado there. But a tornado warning is now in effect for Apsley, Woodview, Northern Peterborough County, Fenelon Falls, Balsam Lake Park, Northern Kawartha Lakes, Lindsay, and Southern Kawartha Lakes, Ontario. Again, that is a tornado warning in effect. This just warning was just announced 4 minutes ago for Apsley, Woodview, Northern Peterborough County, Fenelon Falls, Balsam Lake Park, Northern Kawartha Lakes, Lindsay, Southern Kawartha Lakes in Ontario. Please exercise as much caution as possible. The Toronto Maple Leafs. Well, I didn't know what to expect this offseason. To be honest, from the Maple Leafs, you know, we knew that obviously there were some players, some decisions that were going to have to be made, and some players who weren't going to come back. I think we all just kind of assumed that. But my goodness, Deitch, in the past couple of days, yeah, almost the past 48 hours, we've seen the Leafs linked to the likes of Gabriel Landeskog. We've seen them linked to Darcy Kemper. I don't know how, you know, surprising this is necessarily, and we now know today that Zach Hyman and his agent have gotten permission from the Leafs to explore trading his rights. It does seem, I mean, we talked about the Leafs need to do something to kind of change the chemistry a bit. It seems as if again, if we operate under the assumption there's some fire behind the smoke, we may be seeing more moves than maybe even we thought originally.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know how they get to Landeskog, but that'd be pretty interesting. Bit of trading and cap finessing. But the Zach Hyman thing is interesting and kind of a bummer, just given the flat cap. And there has to be a movement on a goalie, Jeff. So that is, CJ will probably talk to us about. That is something that feels real, and I would expect, you know, if you presume Freddie Anderson's not coming back, like, there's got to be a move for that position somewhere.
Let's bring in Chris Johnson. He's our NHL insider with Sportsnet. Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. Look, I think most of us just kind of assumed that the numbers weren't going to work out for Zach Hyman in Toronto. What does this decision mean, getting permission to explore trading his rights?
Well, on the base level, I guess there's the opportunity for Zach to get a jump on the market and his agent, Todd Reynolds, to be out there and speaking to teams and get a sense, you know, before July 28th without having to do anything that might be considered tampering, which, you know, obviously might go on in general terms at times at this time of year, but what his market value is. And then, you know, potentially you have a position where the Leafs might be able to get a draft pick in terms of trading his rights, maybe even a sign and trade if you could convince a team to sign him to an 8-year deal or do commit to an 8-year term. You know, at this point, Zach can only actually sign that term from a functional standpoint with the Leafs. And so you might have to sign a deal, do a sign and trade. You know, we haven't actually seen one of those in the NHL. I know they've been talked about and explored in the past in some other situations, but, you know, I think that's what it's about. And it's probably also ultimately a sign of goodwill that, you know, this isn't necessarily a breakup that has some bad feelings. I think both sides understand that their interests don't align at this point in time, and the Leafs are doing good by a player that's, you know, done a lot of good for them over the last number of years.
Chris, do you think it's totally over? Is there any financial path towards getting Zach Hyman back?
I think it's over because the only circumstance it wouldn't be over is if there wasn't a good enough market out there. And I'm of the belief from the conversations I've had that the market is real for Zach Hyman, that you're looking at, you know, I don't think he'll get an 8-year deal. That would obviously be the gold standard for someone, you know, at his age who's had some injuries, who's 29. But, you know, I think a 6-year contract somewhere in the range of even as much as $6 million will be out there from other teams. I think that there's multiple teams bidding for him, so he's going to have a lot to consider, but this will be, you know, by far the biggest contract of his career. And so I think that closes the door on Toronto, because reasonably the Leafs were probably looking at something at $4.5 million, say, over the course of a longer contract if he was to stay. And that's just probably too big of, you know, gap to be bridged here. You know, I'll point out sort of interestingly, Dougie Hamilton, who's probably the top name or top player on the free agent board this year, you know, Carolina did something similar with him a few weeks ago and has given him the chance to explore the field early and talk to teams. And I think in that case, it might ultimately lead him back to Carolina because perhaps the market isn't what he was hoping for elsewhere, you know, whereas, you know, I think it's a little different case here with Zach Hyman, where there's going to be some real money thrown at him and some, you know, interesting opportunities. And ultimately that's going to end his time as a Maple Leaf.
So what does the Leafs do to replace him? Like, I understand everything he brings to this team. I get all that, but strategically, tactically, et cetera, how did they replace Zach Hyman? Is there some internal, replacement, or is it going to be a little bit of both, a little internal improvement, somebody from the Marlies plus somebody outside the organization? How would you view that?
I think that the simplest way to look at it is it's not going to be one player. Like, you're probably not bringing in someone who's playing on your top line left wing, who has the penalty killing role that Zach Hyman had, who's necessarily playing, you know, in 6-on-5 situations in the final minute. Like, I think that you have to view it almost in pieces, that you know, that there's multiple players that can do the types of things Zach did, and you know, that might be the way to replace him. Because, you know, really, if you're getting one person who has the package he does, you're probably going to be paying him what Zach Hyman's going to be making, and you could just keep him. And so I think it's a little bit by committee. I mean, the left wing position, other than goaltending, you know, which you guys were highlighting there, is probably the most interesting entering this offseason, because the Leafs have two interesting left wing slots. You know, there's one, if it's Matthews and Marner on a line, they're looking for a left winger, and then you would have Nylander and Tavares also, you know, potentially auditioning for a spot there. I think Nick Robertson as an internal fill will be an option for them. potentially to play in the top six, but that's a bit of a question mark given that, you know, he's only played a handful of NHL games and is still a young guy. And so that's where I think some of the rumors you've heard, whether it was Landeskog's name being out there, Taylor Hall, you know, I know has been linked to the Leafs, you know, they are natural players to slide in there. And then, you know, I think the penalty killing duties that Zach handled can probably be taken by someone in the bottom six. You know, whether that's someone you're bringing in externally, it remains to be seen, but I don't think that you're replacing, you're finding one guy that does all the things that Zach Hyman did. But there's probably a way to, you know, the Leafs management would be doing it, a way to still improve while not committing all that money to one player.
Yeah, it's well said, CJ. I mean, to me, it's a loss. It's a big loss, and I think we'll see that next year. Two more Leaf things for me. What do you expect with Alex Kerfoot, especially with the potential of him being exposed to Seattle? And then let's get to the goaltending. You know, we had Elliot on earlier in the week, and it doesn't look like, even if they're talking to Freddie Anderson, there's a realistic number that they could bring him back. So that means obviously that they got to get somebody to partner with Jack Ham.
Yeah. And you know, I think that the time with Freddie is likely up. That's one where I could potentially see where if maybe the market is, if he sort of strikes out in the market and if they strike out in the market, perhaps you could see an unlikely reunion after the fact, but if we're sort of handicapping it, you know, 2 weeks out from the start of free agency, I think it's very likely that he's moving on and they're going to look somewhere else. You know, I think it's interesting seeing Darcy Kemper's name out there today. I know last season when the Leafs took a real long, hard look at their goaltending, I mean, they thought about moving on from Frederick Anderson after the bubble experience against Columbus, you know, really dove deep on the goaltenders available in free agency and on the trade market. And, you know, I think a guy that they really liked at that time was Darcy Kemper. You know, I think that maybe the questions they had was, you know, he hasn't played under the kind of spotlight that is offered here in Toronto. There's maybe an unknown there in terms of his experience level. If you threw him into, you know, a big game, a game seven, you know, playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs as a starting goaltender. But from a technical standpoint, I know he graded very well in the metrics they were using to look at him. So, you know, that fit makes sense to me. You know, there's going to be options, though. I mean, there's talk that Alex Nedeljkovic from Carolina might not be qualified, which would make him a free agent. You know, Chris Driedger's had two pretty nice part seasons in Florida and, you know, is trending towards becoming a free agent, you know, plus some more known commodities that have been out there. And so I think that the Leafs will have an open mind to a degree, but certainly I don't think we'll be entering next season saying that Jack Campbell is the unquestioned number one of the team. I think that, you know, no matter who they bring in, you're going to be looking at something like a 60-40 split one way or the other and you know, looking to maybe have a true sort of duo there. And, you know, the Leafs are going to have some options as they go through these next few weeks.
One of the things the Las Vegas Golden Knights did in the expansion draft as they put together their team was get Marc-Andre Fleury. And we all know how that worked out for them as part of their team building process. Is there somebody like that out there for the Kraken?
I don't know that there's someone. There's certainly not someone at that level. I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury is a Hall of Fame goaltender from this generation. And, you know, he's still had plenty to give in the 4 years he's played since going to Vegas. You know, but there's, you know, good goaltenders, you know, someone like Jake Allen, who was the Canadiens backup this year, but played a lot of the games during the regular season when Carey Price was injured and played well and has experience in the past as a number one and isn't too old, isn't on too onerous of a contract. I mean, I could see him being selected. You know, Braden Holtby is going to be exposed in this expansion draft from Vancouver. And I know he's had a couple tough years, but he's, you know, someone who's won a Stanley Cup in the past. But, you know, I think the way that Fleury situation played out for Vegas was really beyond the Golden Knights' hands. Cause if you remember at that time, you know, Pittsburgh had just gone on another cup run and Matt Murray, who was, you know, a very young goaltender, had taken the reins from Fleury during that playoff series. And it was sort of at the time, it seemed evident that he was going to be their goaltender of the future. As we know with hindsight, that hasn't worked out. And, you know, arguably the Penguins would have been better off maybe just to lose Matt Murray to Vegas. But, you know, the circumstances in that situation conspired to give Vegas, you know, a really top-notch option entering their first season. I don't see such a clear slam dunk here, but, you know, two guys that do stand out with the experience and that have done it in the past are Allen in particular and maybe even Braden Holtby. And, you know, there's also the chance that someone like Chris Driedger, who I mentioned for the Leafs, ends up going there. And, you know, one of the stories for me of Vegas' expansion experience is, you know, there's a bunch of players that hadn't really gotten a chance for various reasons in their previous teams that were thrust into a bigger role once they got to Vegas and they flourished there. And I could see that playing out for Seattle, where maybe it's a goaltender that doesn't have tons of NHL experience, but is ready to take the next step and will get the opportunity to do so once they get to the Kraken.
CJ, I saw you tweet out the John Cooper video in the handshake line at the Cup, which was pretty cool of Cooper to do that. And it got me thinking, and we talked a little bit about this earlier in the week, about what the Canadiens' future is. And, you know, you sort of would think on face, just given all these young guys, that, man, like, you know, those young guys stay healthy, they're going to be really good. But then the Shea Weber news comes up, and Carey Price, while awesome in the playoffs, is still on the, you know, as we say, the wrong side of 30. So do you have what's your early evaluation of what the Canadiens will be next year?
They're in a really strange place, because you're right. To have that kind of playoff run and how exciting it was, and certainly I don't want to be seen as taking away from any of that, because I do think they earned what they got in this last playoffs. But I think that there's a pretty honest evaluation internally with the Canadiens front office that, you know, they're not just assuming, okay, we roll it back with the same few things and this is going to happen again. I think that they see the potential danger perhaps in the playoff run they had and sort of resting on their laurels and assuming everything will work out. And so, you know, I think for a team that's just finished runner-up to the Stanley Cup, you know, there's likely to be more change contemplated there than you would typically see for the team in that spot, because, you know, I think they recognize, yes, we've got some intriguing young pieces, but, you know, the Stanley Cup ends, and yes, Barry Kotkaniemi is a healthy scratch for them. You know, Alexander Romanov, you know, one of their top defensive prospects, you know, played most of the games in regular season and only got into a handful in the playoffs. And so, you know, I think that they still have to bridge that gap. And so, you know, the one thing the Shea Weber news does open up is, assuming everything goes okay and he's allowed to be placed on long-term injured reserve, which I think is still a bit of an open question in terms of, you know, how the league and everything views his injury situation. But, you know, if we assume that that's going to happen, I mean, it does free up another $7.5 million cap-wise that they can spend this offseason. And, you know, I think that they'll be pretty aggressive with it, because, you know, they were aggressive this season, right? They were the one team, if you go back to last October when we had the last offseason in the pandemic, I mean, they were the one team that went out and spent a ton of money. They were, you know, re-upping players like Jeff Petrie on their own lineup, but trading for Joel Edmondson's rights and signing him to a big deal. They traded for Jake Allen and signed him. I mean, they weren't afraid to spend money then, and I suspect after seeing it pay off that we'll see them as a big player here in the next few weeks. And you know, it's tough to lose Shea for all that he's meant for the team, but I don't know that this is a huge surprise internally, because he's been battling some of these sort of foot and ankle issues, you know, for a couple seasons now. And you know, I think that there's sort of an understanding that you know, he probably wasn't going to be able to play his way through this entire contract. And so, while it came as a bit of a surprise in the hockey world yesterday, I don't think it was a surprise to the Canadiens themselves.
I feel like I'm going to be the teacher that throws that curveball question on at you in a multiple choice test, but
pick C.
That's actually pretty, that's not bad. Without needing an hour to do it, what would be the best outcome for the Canadiens with Shea Weber? I'm talking about how the money would have to be accounted for, right? Like LTIR. What's the thing that all these sides have to get over in order for that to happen? Because it's clear that there's some talks going on with the league and the Players Association. Can you maybe just distill that for us?
Well, the best outcome for Shea and the Canadiens, but I don't know if it would be possible, is him being healthy enough to play at some point and resuming his career. But, you know, it doesn't seem like it's trending in that direction. And so I think that the second best option for the Canadiens would be that this is deemed a hockey injury, that you know, that it satisfies any neutral challenges, that you know, he's truly is injured to the degree he can't continue his career, and he can finish out basically on their long-term injured reserve list. You know, we've seen players in the past in that position. David Clarkson's one that comes to mind. Sometimes their rights get traded to other teams. You know, in Clarkson's case, he went from Toronto to Columbus to Vegas to Toronto, you know, after not being able to play hockey anymore. You know, so that would give the Canadiens the freedom potentially to trade his cap hit away if they wanted, or they could spend over the cap by that number. It would allow Shea to collect his remaining paychecks while easing into retirement. And I think that that's probably the best outcome. The worst outcome would be if for some reason, and I, you know, I don't have full view here, but if the league didn't allow them to use LTIR, if he had to stay on the active cap but wasn't able to play or wasn't able to play at the level he would like to, you know, that would probably be the worst case scenario here. But you know, I've got no reason to believe there's any funny business going on. I think it's just a matter of the fact that he played in the Stanley Cup final, what, a week ago or 10 days ago, and you know, now we're talking about his career maybe being over. I think that there's probably some medical things that have to be satisfied before that's allowed to be considered the outcome.
CJ, again, understanding that the money will not be anything like they've been paid, but do you see any market for Zach Parise or Ryan Suter in terms of like one of these teams that maybe, you know, is looking for some veterans, you know, for like a playoff run in the same way maybe the Leafs examined Wayne Simmons, Joe Thornton, because I saw that Minnesota bought them out. That was pretty interesting to me, just to see those two guys theoretically available out there.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I think what stands out to me is, yes, they're going to have tons of value, and I think once they get over the shock of it, particularly Ryan Suter, who didn't see this coming, you know, this is a really intriguing opportunity because they've earned their money. They're still going to be paid another $7 million, a little bit less than that, for their buyouts. I mean, these guys are over $100 million in their careers. They can literally make the next decision based on where they want to live, where they have the best chance to win, and take a team-friendly kind of contract and do it in good faith and help that team have success. And so, yes, I think they both have a lot of hockey left. You know, in particular, Suter is, to me, still unquestionably, you know, a second-pairing guy in the league. He's not the 30-minute a night player he was at times in Minnesota, but, you know, I think he has a lot to offer. I think Parise in the right role will find a home quite easily as well. And so, you know, once you get over the fact that I'm sure that there's a bit of a pride hit there, a little disappointment that, you know, it was such a big moment when they signed the same deal on the same day in July 2012, you know, coming back to sort of their home state to restore some excitement to the Wild. I mean, once you get beyond the fact that maybe didn't pan out the way everyone had hoped, I think that there's a tremendous opportunity for each of them to still chase a Stanley Cup and, you know, to do so without having to worry about the financial side of the game because they're well taken care of.
CJ, good of you to do this as always, my friend. Stay safe, be well.
All right, and everyone be careful of those tornadoes.
Absolutely, take care. Thanks, that is Chris Johnson, our NHL insider at Sportsnet. The Toronto Blue Jays will get back on the field tomorrow night. Salem Field in Buffalo against the Texas Rangers. Boston and the Yankees are scheduled to play today. Although the Yankees canceled batting practice today because they are going through COVID-19 testing as a result of a couple of their players returning positive tests. So the test and tracing stuff is in full effect. No indication yet that the game will be called off. The Red Sox have, in fact, already submitted their lineup. So we shall wait and see how that turns out. Jeff Passan is ESPN's MLB insider. He'll join us next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. So we had Sean Casey of the MLB Network and host of the Mariners podcast on Baseball Central a little earlier today. And we're talking about Shohei Ohtani and the impact he's already had in the game and the impact, of course, that he had in the All-Star game. And as only Sean Casey can, he came up with a rather intriguing parallel. And I don't know if our next guest, Jeff Passan of ESPN, heard it. I'm willing to bet he didn't because it'd be nice if he did and was listening to the show, but I'm willing to bet he was doing something else. Mr. Passan, how are you?
Mr. Blair, how are you?
Sean Casey said, seeing Shohei Ohtani, he said, now I know what it must have been like seeing the Wright brothers make their first flight attempt. Which, you know, I thought was pretty...
That's a little... I love Sean Casey. That's a little much.
Yeah, I thought it was too, but I thought it was also, I thought it was also kind of fun. You know, look, Shohei Ohtani's couple of days at the All-Star break, you know, hitting the 512-foot home run in batting practice, or in batting practice, and then you know, hitting 100 miles on the radar gun. Never mind what he did in the home run derby. For now, he's a big deal. Did he come out of that any bigger deal, Jeff? I'll spit it out.
I was going to say, you'll get there, buddy. You'll land the plane. Yes, I think after this week, he is a much bigger deal. And it's not going to be immediately obvious. But the one problem I think baseball's had in recent years has not been convincing people who love baseball that baseball is cool or great or interesting or fun. That's not a hard thing to do. If you're in on the game, you're in on the game. If you're not in on the game, if you're a casual fan, if you're somebody who's bought into the idea that baseball is boring, it is slow, it is all of the things that its critics and detractors say, then there has to be an entry point where you are so intrigued or fascinated by someone or something that you will get past this narrative that you have written in your head and give it a chance. And Shohei Ohtani is that thing. He is that person. He is that talent. He is that, that differentiator, I think, that will make casual fans or skeptics or critics give baseball a chance. And that's all you need, Jeff. Yeah, you
right.
Just need a chance to watch the guy, and you see him, and you see how hard he hits it, and you see how fast he runs, and you see the velocity with which he throws, and you say to yourself, what the hell is this? Like, how is a human being like this possible? Because for everything that Babe Ruth did, he did it pre-integration. He did it pre-velocity. For everything that Double Duty Ratcliffe and Bullet Rogan did in the Negro Leagues, they did it, you know, against competition that simply was not the best in the world all the time. Shohei Ohtani is doing it in an era of in-sport specialization, where guys aren't just pitchers or hitters, but pitchers particularly are relievers who go up against one side of the plate, starters go 5-6, you know, if they're lucky and good, 7 innings. It is a place in the sport right now that is perhaps the least ripe I've ever seen for somebody doing what he's done, because it's so hard to do each of the things he's doing individually, and to do them at the same time boggles the mind.
Paston, you had a very good week in addition to Shohei Ohtani and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. I'm not going to have you relive some of the statements that you made on ESPN, but you know, Blair and I talked about this briefly. I think even people in Canada know Stephen A. Smith's words and then subsequent apology. But from this came a pretty interesting conversation about players who are not native English speakers and what is their ability to sort of carry the game market-wise. And I think if nothing else, like the All-Star Game and the Home Run Derby proved that the league is in a great place with Shohei Ohtani, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Fernando Tatis, Acuna, etc. And I wonder from your perspective, Jeff, now, so what's the next step for the league to try to, like, bring in, as you said, particularly younger video game generation types to experience or sample baseball? I know we say this all the time when the league has young guys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but I do think this is different, and I think the reason it's different is because Ohtani is a once-in-a-multiple-generation player, not a once-in-a-generation player.
I think that you are spot on, and I was wondering, see, like, I enjoy coming on with you guys because I feel like you've been on this side of the business and
you're saying we're old, Jeff. Thank you.
No, trust me, I felt old at the All-Star game too. Like that press box was filled.
Well, you had a suit on, Passan. I mean, you were like something out of Glengarry Glen Ross.
I go to sleep in a suit. Like, come on. I mean, this is the.
Yeah, I know you don't. That's a negative. We don't need to go any further, but that's a negative.
let me ask you a question, though. I was sitting there at one point and asking myself, like, is baseball on the verge of a moment? I don't know if it is or not, and maybe it's my myopia because I'm around the sport all the time and see it, and we go into our own little echo chambers, and there are things about the sport that are just brutal and dreadful. But if baseball can figure out how to speed up the game a little bit, I feel like right now with Ohtani and Tatis, like that's about as well positioned as baseball's been since like Ken Griffey, in terms of just having two guys, and you can throw in Vlad Guerrero, you can throw in Acuna, you can throw in Soto, and let's acknowledge, by the way, that those are four Dominican guys and one Japanese guy. I feel like baseball has an opportunity right now that it needs to seize in not shoving these guys down everybody's throat, because I don't think you have to. I just think they need to be as visible as humanly possible, because the wonder of their talent sells this game better than any of their words ever could, or anyone else's words could sell any other game.
I was joking a little bit with you about, you know, Sean Casey and his Wright brothers reference, but one of the things I did find interesting, he had Dante Bichette in his podcast, and I kind of wish I'd gone down this road with Dante, because we've had him on our show several times, and we've talked about several things. Usually it's having him on as dad of Bo, but Sean had Dante on, and they were talking about, and I don't know if you necessarily agree with this, but I found it at least interesting. Dante was making the point that one of the things that worries him about baseball in particular, mm-hmm. but it really resonated with hockey and will resonate with hockey parents. He said, I think we tend to overcoach our kids. And he was talking about, you know, Bo's experience. You know the story. Everybody wanted Bo to change his swing. Well, Bo yep. wasn't going to change his swing. And Dante uses the phrase dynamic athleticism. But he made the point, look at the stars now. Ohtani, as you said, yeah, you know, in an area of specialization, he is the unspecialist. He is a true unicorn. Tatis Jr., Vladdy, Soto, Acuna Jr. And yes, a lot of these guys, these aren't all folks from humble backgrounds who, you know, had no access to training facilities or anything like that. But his point was, he thought the reason you're still seeing kids come out of Latin America and you're seeing Ohtani play with a joy is because it hasn't been coached out of them. And I found that fascinating.
Well, I mean, if you look at Dominican kids, though, they've been playing baseball, the majority of them who are signing at 16 years old, they've been playing baseball professionally since they were 13, maybe even okay. younger. Mm-hmm. Like they've been taken out of school, and it has been a job for them. So they have been, like, they're getting coached. I don't know if they're getting coached wrong, like the way that American kids are. And I see it. I have a 13-year-old. Mm-hmm. He's a baseball player. He must not be my kid because he's good. And I see the way that that parents run the show here. Like, it's very interesting getting a view of the youth development system in the United States in baseball, where a lot of it is seen almost as a social event for parents. And where they are guiding these kids toward places that kids frankly don't need to be. I'm sorry, kids don't need to be playing 80 games a summer when they're 13 years old. It's completely obscene. I think what they do down in the DR is they train skills. And that's not what they do here. They play here. They play and they play and they play and they try to win. And the winning, I think, takes a significant toll on kids and burns them out early here. I think baseball's biggest problem, guys, in the United States is that it's country club sport, which is hilarious to think about. Baseball, like this humble game played on sandlots, turning into a country club sport. It's true.
It's the same thing as hockey. You know what? It's the same thing as hockey is an upper middle class sport now. You do not have the poor farm boy from Saskatchewan skating on ponds. You just don't.
Yep. It's the big problem with youth sports in general, that it has priced itself out in many respects of middle class in some regards, in lower middle class and people who are struggling, there's no chance that they're going to get the opportunity to play baseball.
Jeff, the Trevor Bauer story is an ugly one. Even as we continue to, even as authorities obviously will make their way through investigations. Last I saw, is on administrative leave. I'm going to ask you sort of to play a little bit of crystal balling here. What is your expectation regarding Trevor Bauer as we head deeper into the second half of the baseball season?
I'm going to cop out here because I'm reporting this story, and the idea of crystal balling and throwing my opinion into something as charged as this is just not something I'm comfortable doing. So I'm going to go like straight facts here and let you guys infer what's going on. July 23rd is a very important date for Trevor Bauer. It's the date that his accuser and him will be in court in Los Angeles County as he tries to dispute the temporary restraining order that was granted for her. And in that case, it is going to be Bauer's first opportunity to himself publicly, not through statements, not through lawyers or anything like that, for himself to publicly deny and provide evidence against the idea that he sexually assaulted this woman. And it has a chance to be a complete circus. And the fact that the administrative leave goes through July 27th, 4 days after that, and the fact that Pasadena Police Department is expected sometime soon, don't know when, but sometime soon, render a judgment and to send along evidence to the district attorney and see if there's going to be charges filed. All of this is going to come together at once. I will say this, and I feel fairly comfortable saying this. If Trevor Bauer does get charged, I'm not sure he's going to be back on the field this season.
Jeff, let us know if you...
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, baseball's just announced that tonight's Yankees Red Sox game has been postponed because of multiple Yankees positive tests. If you got a run, let me know. Or are you?
No, Buster's at the game. He's
there. You go. Oh God, I love it. You know what my line always was? Columnist is down there. And then when I was a columnist, it was that's why God invented beat guys. Let them go and do it. I'll sit up top and pontificate. So Yankees Red Sox game.
I've known about this for 5 minutes. That's how much I love you guys. I'll just stay here with you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Well, it kind of ruined my next question. I was going to get you to explain to me what I need to know about Jaron Duran. And I was looking at the Red Sox schedule. They have 8 against the Yankees, 6 against Toronto, 3 against Tampa Bay. They could have this division wrapped up by the trade deadline, could they not?
I'm not going to say. I mean, that's a good division, right?
Yeah.
In the idea that even if they go in, let's say they go into August with an 8-game lead, which I don't think is going to happen, by the way, but let's say they do that. I think the Rays are good enough to catch them, and I think the Rays are going to be getting better down the stretch. Nick Anderson might be coming back. They've got Wander Franco up now. They've still got more in the minor leagues. I think Luis Patino is going to be really important. They need someone like him to step up. And, you know, it's nice to have Andrew Kittredge going to the All-Star game. It's nice to have Colin McHugh being – and I'm dead serious when I say this. Like, over the last 6 weeks, Colin McHugh might, outside of Jacob deGrom, be the best pitcher in baseball.
Oh, yeah, we've seen him. We've seen him firsthand. I would agree with you on that.
Yeah, I mean, he's been absolutely phenomenal. So the idea that the Red Sox, yeah, they're bringing up Duran, but I'm sorry, I've seen too many rookies struggle to think that he's destined to hit the ground running and be an impactful player right now. They are getting Chris Sale back, and I've seen enough of Chris Sale to think, yeah, he's going to hit the ground running and be an impactful player. So adding a guy of that ilk to a team that's in first place in that division, yeah, the Red Sox are formidable, but they're not clearly, to me, the team that's going to run away with this. And I'm sorry, maybe I'm naive about this because there is excitement followed by disappointment. I still think the Jays have a really good shot at making the postseason.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we'll know. I mean, speaking of scheduling, they've got 8 games against the Red Sox, so I think we'll know pretty soon. And it just happens to dovetail with the trade deadline, so I think we'll have an idea very soon. Mr. Passan, we're going to let you scoot as always. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate it, gentlemen.
Jeff Passan, MLB Insider with ESPN. And Mr. Deitch, you were right. He had a very good week. His response to Stephen A. Smith was measured and 145% accurate.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say, Jeff, quickly is Jeff pointed out the Trevor Bauer story, Jeff, really could explode nationally upon that hearing, as Passan said. Not only will we hear from Bauer for the first time, but, you know, like in terms of competitiveness, Jeff, we're talking about, you know, one of the best pitchers in baseball on the defending World Series champion. I mean, that's a big, you know, the All-Star game sort of gave us a lot of feel-good stuff, and I think people forgot about the Bauer story for a little bit, but that story's coming like a train.
I'll tell you, you know what, though? I don't think it's going to have that much of an impact because he is kind of universally detested. And I don't think there will be – I mean, it'll have an impact, obviously, in the Dodgers. Don't get me wrong. But in terms of the game itself, I don't know. I don't think there's going to be a lot of sympathy or empathy for him. I just don't.
Well, I agree with that, but I think given the magnitude of him as a pitcher, I just think it's a major story. And if he's gone for the year, obviously the Dodgers are still good, but that's, you know, you're talking about a significant player in the league out.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, though, there will be at least, well, let's put it this way. What if the New York Mets, with everything they'd gone through, had signed Trevor Bauer? With all the issues they had with Jared Porter, with all the things they've been fighting, or with all the things that have involved them. What if they'd signed Trevor Bauer? How would that look?
Also, I agree. And New York, by the way, not to say Los Angeles is a small market town, but because it's not. But New York, Jeff, is a much more hyper-intensive tabloid sports town because Los Angeles is at its core an entertainment Hollywood town. That would be that story would be beyond huge in New York. So the Mets got very lucky that they did not sign Trevor Bauer this year.
We will step away and come back. Tim and friends are next. We'll get you set for it. It's Writer's Block. Well, I guess if nothing else, Richard Deitch, the postponement of the Yankees-Red Sox game just serves as a reminder of how COVID-19 is still among us. The Yankees and Red Sox game was postponed tonight as a result of positive COVID-19 tests among members of the Yankees. And just for your information, the Yankees are, in fact, not only are they one of the teams that reached the 85% vaccination threshold, they are one of the teams in baseball that blew by it. They reached it weeks ago. So they were an organization that had an extreme amount of adherence.
Yeah. I wonder what that means heading forward, too, Jeff. Right, like for the next couple of games for them.
Oh yeah, not only that, and I also, I wonder if that has any impact on the Jays vis-a-vis their, their discussions with the federal
government. It could, because we're talking in real time here, but like in theory, you're going to have to reschedule these, at least one Red Sox game and perhaps a couple, given that they have a three-game series with them. So,
I'm also wondering, though, Richard, if, you're trying to make the case that we have everything under control. And I guess the positive here is, baseball's, the testing process worked. That's the positive. True. But at the same time, if you've got a team with a fairly significant degree of adherence to vaccination, and you can still have this issue, I don't know.
The Yankees have the Red Sox in August and September, so they could do some doubleheaders if they need to. It looks like.
Yeah, but anyhow, certainly a story to stay on top of. That is it for us. Again, if you're out there, if you're anywhere north of the city, northeast of the city, please, 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 please keep track of the weather. Whatever app you're using, whatever radio station you're listening to, please keep track of the weather. Please stay safe. We'll talk to you tomorrow.